Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this New Books Network podcast. My name is Catriona Gold, and I'm a PhD candidate at University College London. Today, I'm very excited to be speaking with Ruth Wilson-Gilmore about her brand new book, Abolition Geography, Essays Toward Liberation, which came out in May 2022 with Verso. Ruth Wilson-Gilmore is Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences and American Studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, where she is also Director of the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics. She is also the author of Golden Gulag and Opposition in Globalizing California. Abolition Geography, her latest book, is a collection of Ruthie's writings spanning the past three decades, including talks, interviews, and three pieces co-authored with Craig Gilmore. This book was edited by Brenna Bandar and Alberto Toscano, who also provide its introduction. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Ruthie.
Hi, it's so good to be here. Thank you for inviting me to join you today.
Thank you. I'd like to start by asking you to tell me a little about yourself, your academic trajectory, your activism, how those intersect. What would you like readers to know about the work you've been doing?
Oh, sure. That's a great question and a nice way to start. Well, first of all, I'm 72 years old, and I have had a wonderfully complicated life, part of it in academia, a lot of it out of academia, but also always one with a bend toward trying to understand the world in order to change it. So the intellectual activity is always present, whether or not I've been involved in academia as a student or as a professor or as a scholar, for that matter. And I went back to school in the early 1990s when I was in my 40s to study geography because, as I think I mentioned in one of the pieces in this book, it seemed to be one of the last materialist disciplines, one where you could really talk about the real world in its symbolic as well as political, economic aspects, and try to figure out how things were changing and toward what end, and particularly, and this is my interest throughout my life, how ordinary people organize their energy and institutions to make their own lives better.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, tell me a bit then about how this book came into being, because it spans three decades, right? And it's a huge amount of writing. It's a big book with lots of fascinating insights in. Could you tell me a little bit about the writing featured in the book? Is it all previously unpublished? Does it have a unifying theme? What do you talk about in the book?
Well, it's most of it was published before, almost every single bit other than the introduction that Alberto and Brenna wrote. Was published somewhere in the past. I started writing the oldest pieces in the book in the late 80s and early 1990s as I, along with so many people around the world, were trying to figure out in the context of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the structural adjustment programs that were renewing the impoverishment of the formerly colonial world, the rise of the forces of organized violence in the overdeveloped world, especially as perceivable in police and prisons. We were thinking about all that and trying to figure out, well, what should we do that we haven't understood before? And how can we bring the theories and methods and commitments that we already had through the 1960s and 1970s and through the 1980s to inform struggle on, as it were, a new terrain. So I started writing to figure these things out because that's, you know, one of the ways that we, many of us think, is by writing. And a lot of the writing that's in the book originally appeared in the public as talks, and therefore I had a lot of interaction with people and revised my thinking, and I hope sometimes sharpened it. And so that's how those pieces emerged over time. And then why are they, as it were, suddenly in a book? Well, first of all, it took a long time. There's nothing sudden about the book. But Alberto Toscana and Brenna Brandar approached me and said, look, we've been reading your work. It's hard to find. It was published all over the place in these disparate and sometimes very tiny journals, many places that don't have a prominent online presence. What if we put all this work together into a book? It was their idea. They brought the idea to Verso. The wonderful Rosie Warren at Verso immediately gave it a thumbs up. And after several years of very hard work, most of it done by Alberto and Brenna, and also a couple of my research assistants, and who are also comrades and scholars themselves, Patrick Didaw and Hillary Wilson, the book appeared as this beautiful thing. I'm very happy about it.
Yeah, it is a beautiful thing too, both in content and in its form. Verso done another great job on that there on the cover. Not that we should judge it by the cover, but if we were to, right, that's great. I love hearing the stories of how books come into being themselves. And this is a rich one. So I want to start, okay, this is a cliched place to start, but I think it's important. I actually want to start with the title. So the title is Abolition Geography, Essays Towards Liberation. So quite a lot to chew on there already. I want to start first with this idea of abolition. So if you'll bear with me for a moment, I first came across the concept of abolition through veganism, which as a liberation movement has both intersections and shared language with other movements for justice, including borrowing this term, abolition. And among vegans, one of many tensions is that between abolitionist scholars like Lee Hall, who push for a more expansive definition of veganism as a total reconfiguration of humans' relationship with humans and non-human animals, including respecting free living animals' right to exist, and reformists, usually represented by major organizations, who would argue this is too ambitious, that what we should focus on is improving husbandry standards or ending particularly cruel practices. And so that's a debate that I'm personally very invested in, and I have a good sense of what abolitionism means for vegans. And I think given that the term abolitionist is widespread in the context of other movements too, and also has come to prominence in the last couple of years, a special prominence following the murder of George Floyd, our listeners probably have their own understandings or questions or maybe misperceptions about what abolition means. So I know what it means to me in a day-to-day context. What does it mean for you, Ruthie?
Oh, I love how you put that question, and thank you for immediately situating it in a world that might not immediately come to the minds of a lot of people who are listening to us today, the world of veganism. And those two extremes, which are, you know, full of tension, very much shape how it is that I and many of my comrades are thinking about abolitionism today. And that is to think in terms of and through the energies and processes of thorough reconfiguration, not just slight improvements. And let me give an example from the 19th century and the a moment of abolition that many listeners are probably somewhat aware of, and that is the time when the British Empire, quote, abolished the slave trade. All right. They didn't abolish slavery, they abolished the slave trade. And we won't go into, you know, all of the struggles and features through which that eventually emerged in the year 1807 as that particular commitment on the part of the British Empire. But what, from the point of view of the British Empire, did that mean? It meant that abolition became a policing function. And so the British Empire sent out its fast and well-armed ships to ply the South Atlantic, to interrupt ships that were carrying captives from West and West Central Africa to the Americas to labor in plantations and cities and mines and factories and all of the places where enslaved people labored. Well, that abolition, which was an interruption in an aspect of unfreedom, is not the total reconfiguration of everything. It's that other abolition that you pointed toward, where reformists are saying, well, let's just have kinder, more thoughtful animal husbandry and kinder, more thoughtful human, non-human interaction, and things will be better in the world. The radical abolition that you described on the part of the thinker you named as the reconfiguration thinker about veganism is the kind of abolition that I and my comrades draw together in the present by looking back through time. And what we take to be central to our understanding is that abolition is always presence. And so the question is, the presence of what? And at answering that question means the presence of what kinds of relationships between and among people where to do what kinds of things to what end. So we've kind of leaned into the second word of the title of the book, which is geography. And insofar as geography is, and it's kind of most crude, the study of people, places, and things, then it is further the study of why things happen where they do, or as I kind of say with a little bit of a twinkle somewhere in the book, not where is Nebraska, but why is Nebraska, which is to say, what are the combinations of human ingenuity, energy, inequality, and human environmental interactions that create the possibility for a place to be a productive landscape, a landscape of home, a landscape of freedom, a landscape of unfreedom, and what are the possibilities for transforming these landscapes that do already exist in the world into places of greater freedom where more and more people can flourish. So that is put together what abolition geography is for me. And to put, you know, my finger on it a bit more explicitly, I take very seriously the teaching and suggestions that W.E.B. Du Bois put together in his monumentally wonderful book from 1935, Black Reconstruction in America. And it's in that book that he proposed that there were two different kinds of democracy. He said there's industrial democracy and there's abolition democracy. And he tried to show us in the many chapters of the book how the elements of abolition democracy, at least for a while, flourished in the U.S. South. And I and many other scholars have looked around the world to see other examples of abolition democracy flourishing. So Angela Davis wrote a book or put together a book of her lectures on this topic. Christina Heatherton has a new book coming out in the fall that lifts up the kind of what she calls the abolitionist international of the 19th century that gives us some insights into radicalism of the 20th century. There are many examples, some of them short-lived, others with fairly long lives, where we see people making abolition geographies by reconfiguring thoroughly relationships of people, natural resources, the environment, and strangers, all of the above.
Right. So thorough reconfiguration would be, you know, if we had to summarize, that would be what this means, right? And I mean, I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about the sort of specifically geographical insights and approaches you take, because I mean, I think it's really interesting that you are flying the flag as well for geography, as problematic a history as that discipline also has. But I think it's interesting, especially because geography is a somewhat beleaguered discipline in the US. You know, the loss of geography departments and its sort of marginalization, or people don't really understand it. People do think that geography is, as you say, at the start of the fourth essay here, scholar activists in the mix. You know, you were asked by a former student when you started your PhD, why would you go and study, with the political interest you have, why would you be going to study where is Nebraska? As you say, the question is not where is Nebraska, but why? Why is Nebraska? And so, I mean, yeah, how do geographers try, or how have geographers have tried to get at these questions? And yeah, how do you find being a geographer, making those interventions and engaging with sort of other scholars? Do you find there is an understanding of the contribution that geography brings, or is that something you have to keep hammering home? Yeah, and I'd also be interested within and outside geography. I mean, you mentioned Du Bois. I'm also wondering who else's work has been influential, you know, in shaping your thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting that you raise the fact that geography as a discipline in the United States has been very beleaguered, and indeed it has. Many geography departments closed between the latter part of the 1930s and the early part of the 1950s. And some of them were replaced by what came to be known as area studies, and others just were absorbed into planning or economics or history or anthropology or sociology, for that matter. It just went. And of course, part of the reason for that beleaguered state was that a good deal of late 19th and early 20th century geography, like a good deal of other leading social science, and I'd say across the board disciplines in higher education, in the English-speaking world, as well as beyond, had taken up the work of justifying inequality between and among peoples, between and among nations, between and among the colonizer and the colonized, between and among the free and the unfree. They were working very hard to make all of that seem natural, necessary, and inevitable. and where geography went a bridge too far was to embrace many of the principles and practices, heinous, of eugenics that were also extremely formative for Nazi thought. Now, Nazis did not have to look to geographers to develop many of the insights and practices that they put into action during the rise and then decline of what Mark Mesauer calls Hitler's empire. And certainly plenty of people have showed that the colonial experience of many, not only those who were colonized by Germany, but those who were colonized by many of the imperial powers of the North Atlantic, certainly had exercised a lot of the forms of and policies that materialized as the Nazi war against so many people in the world. Geography fell, but some of the underlying principles in geography, which is true of any discipline, remained useful. And they were useful in that they enable people to think very specifically and diligently about the, I keep repeating this and I will repeat it more as we talk, but the relationships between humans and the environment, the particular ways that in various climates and with various combinations of natural and other resources that the land can flourish, that people and non-human life can flourish together, the organization of the built environment, the relentless urbanization of humans on the planet in the 20th century, all of these things are questions that come to the fore in any serious program of geographic study. And in fact, maybe I'll pause here to remind listeners that that word geography is geo, world, graphy, right. So it's not only right about the world, but it's also how we humans, in relation to all of these forces that are not human, organize and reorganize the planet. So it's how the world is written rather than who writes about the world that matters.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, it's also sort of clear from when reading your work, I suppose, you know, I'm asking you to explain here for the benefit of our listeners. Of course, our listeners should read the work too, and it will become apparent how geographical analysis is sort of a cornerstone of your thinking and the sorts of scholarship which inform it. I think the fifth essay in this book, Race and Globalization, has a sort of is a really excellent, I think, introduction to a lot of the ways in which these questions are geographical questions of injustice. So, I mean, you talk about how the movement of prisoners is a wealth transfer between poor communities. Effectively, I mean, you talk in Golden Gulag, which maybe you might want to say a few words about kind of, yeah, those fundamentally spatial economic aspects of prisons. So not just a sort of question of moral outrage, but it's also a question about what prisons are doing for whom, right? That's something else you ask throughout, and what process is there embedded in, if I'm understanding correctly. So, I mean, in this book, you describe prisons as a geographical solution to socioeconomic problems. And I think those kind of materialist commitments extend throughout your work. So I don't know if you'd like to talk about some of that earlier work, perhaps?
Sure, I have. that book right here. Sure. And let me just say, although Golden Gulag was published in 2007, a number of the pieces in Abolition Geography are older than Golden Gulag. I wrote some of the pieces in Abolition Geography before I went back to school. I wasn't a scholar. I was a dropout. And I was, you know, involved in political work. And in that context, thinking and writing, again, not for to make a career, but to figure out what to do next. So thinking about your question, as you put it, that... the movement of prisoners is a form of wealth and also income circulation transfer, brings us actually to something more fundamental that I want to talk about first, and then we can go back to prisons. That is the factors of production that make anything possible are land and labor, which is say human energy and innovation, and ingenuity and persistence, and very often some kind of money or other medium that makes it possible for people to get things that they don't have so that they can do what they want to do, and our capacity to organize ourselves and each other to do these things. One of the key ways that such organization happens, not the only way, but a key way, are the various capacities of the state, whether the state is organizing public education or public health or public sewers or public water or public prisons or courts. You know, these are forms of organization. So in studying, as I did, to shreds, how it happened that the state of California set out to realize what one of its analysts called the biggest prison building project in the history of the world. This was in the early 1980s. The analyst said this. I started with these fundamental factors of production to ask, well, how did they become available? Why weren't those factors, land, labor, money, state capacity, doing other things? What was the relationship of capitalist firms in California, one of the richest territorial units on the planet? If it were a country, it would be one of the biggest economies, top 10. Why was all this land available? Why was all this labor available? Why was all this state capacity that wasn't developed to put people in prison turned to that activity? And the answer, the explanation, couldn't be, and indeed turned out not to be, something called crime. It was, however, a combination of what I've come over the years to describe as a combination of, on the one hand, organized abandonment, that modestly educated people in the prime of life who, in a different political economic configuration, would be making their livings and supporting their households, making, moving, growing, and caring for things and people. As that shifted away, we have surplus people whose labor capacity was not absorbed into the political economy in that territory in any other way. And I can go through a similar discussion of what was happening with land, especially in rural areas, but also urban. And I could go through an explanation of where the money capital came from that might have been used, and in earlier iterations of public finance was used, to build highways, roads, dams, schools, hospitals, housing. And finally, how all of the accumulated talents, which is to say the bureaucratic and fiscal capacities of the California state and the various municipalities in that state turn toward the work of locking up hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. I go through all of that detail to emphasize that the factors, as I keep saying, that came together in the biggest prison building project in the history of the world could have come together differently. And that it's a matter of political will, which is to say the organization of organized people on their own behalf, that is necessary to change that trajectory, to achieve the thorough reconfiguration of, in this case, California, but everywhere where inequality is the deepest, mass incarceration and criminalization are most profound. That's true in the United States, US-wide. It's true in the United Kingdom. It's true in India and Brazil. It's true in South Africa. It's true in many, many places. And that the deepening of inequality enables the rise of the forces of organized violence, that's police, military, prisons, courts. And that deepening becomes more and more profound as the organized abandonment that produced the crisis in the first place refreshes and renews itself. So what's an example of that? An example of that can be anything from the fact that people still can't drink the water in Flint, Michigan, to the fact that any number of small municipal governments are dependent on fines and fees for their own revenue because the capitalist firms are not paying taxes. And therefore, the police become more and more powerful. And indeed, they become so powerful that all of those fees that go into the coffers of the municipalities then go back out into police salaries and nothing else. So, you know, we can look at how everyday life has been so remarkably distorted over the last 40 years, such that young people, I guess people your age, can't even imagine things being different because this is what normal had become. But it isn't natural. It's not inevitable, and it's not necessary.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think you talk quite powerfully, you know, about these sort of materialist aspects, but also their intersection with the cultural questions of, I mean, what we are able to imagine, right? So I think, yeah, I really liked also your interview with fellow geographer and artist Trevor Paglen in this same volume here, Abolition Geography. And you say there that, so you're talking about the military industrial complex and also you talk about the prison industrial complex. But you say of the military industrial complex that it's had a huge cultural effect on this country. So you say that one of the key cultural effects of the military-industrial complex has been to constantly refresh, renew, and reinvigorate the cultural violence that holds this country, that is the US, together. And that people essentially have a permanent warfare mentality, assuming that their neighbor is threatening them, that they should harm them if they come over the fence, and talk about that almost as human nature. And you assert that that's not human nature, that's American culture. And I think that you talk in a really compelling way, especially throughout this volume, about those questions of, it is a question of imagination fundamentally as well, right? And so I don't know if you'd like to expand on that, but I would be interested in also learning how, if the role of scholars is in some way, if we're trying to do something positive anyway, is to change the way people think about these questions. I wonder how if you were able to give some examples, or how you think it's productive for scholars to engage with or contribute to abolitionist movements. And also, what does an abolitionist movement look like, and how do we distinguish that from a reformist movement, right? You actually talk about some really powerful sort of examples in this book, elsewhere in the book, of what I think we would call abolitionist movements. When you talked about justice for janitors, sorry, this is a slightly long-winded question, but it really made me think about the current struggles in London, the London universities, between the Independent Workers' Union of Great Britain, that's the IWGB, and universities in London as employers of precarious workers. Who may be employed on sort of subcontracted forms of labor, have fewer rights, poorer pay than other workers at the university, and so I would think of that maybe. I don't know if you're familiar with that campaign, if you would call that abolitionist or reformist, or what you would call that, and how you would situate these kinds of contemporary labor movements would also be an interesting question. But anywhere in there you want to jump in would be great. How can scholars contribute, and what should we think about as an abolitionist movement?
All right, how can scholars contribute? It's a great question, and I don't think I have a quick answer, but there is something I want to say as an aside before I come back to some of the contemporary struggles like the one that you just described that I see as full of abolition possibilities, or the way I put it in a conversation at the LSE I had not too long ago, that have abolitionist characteristics without necessarily the people who are organizing those struggles thinking of themselves as, oh, yes, we are abolitionists. I don't think that that's a necessary thing for the outcome to be enhancing movement toward liberation. But let me say something about schools and universities. They're crossroads. They're really kind of incredible things. And they've been ruined, attacked relentlessly for years and years and years. I recognize all of that. But I don't have a lot of patience for people who come to me saying, oh, the academy, bad, 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 bad. Oh, the university, bad, 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 bad. It's like, yeah, but I mean, it's in the context of all this other bad, 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 bad. So the question is, what can we do together? Now, one of my favorite stories of many stories of how universities are crossroads is the one that happened here in Lisbon, Portugal, where I am now, right around the corner from where I live, in fact. It's 5 minutes on foot. It was the house where the overseas students who had come to Lisbon to do their graduate study lived together. Under the dictatorship, under the Salazar dictatorship, when Salazar had unilaterally declared that the colonies were not colonies anymore, they were just overseas provinces, and therefore Portugal was not a colonial power, the dictatorship, the Portuguese government, worked very hard to identify and train up a comprador bourgeoisie everywhere that Portugal had a colonial presence, right? And that was true also for the British Empire, the French Empire, all the empires did that. They all did it. They all trained up local bourgeoisies for a couple of reasons. One was to have somebody, you know, on the ground whose relatively elite status might make them more, as it were, loyal to the colonial power and less so to the colonized. And also because it was pretty clear from the early part of the 20th century that the costs of colonialism were going to become prohibitive. And therefore, the goal should be to establish relations in the colony such that when independence happened, there would still be a political and economic circulation of money, resources, talent, and so forth. All right, so that's all background for our audience to understand that when Amílcar Cabral and Agostinho Neto and other people who wound up being among the leadership of the anti-colonial movements in places like Cabo Verde, Guinea-Bissau, Angola, and Mozambique, and elsewhere, came to Lisbon for their graduate work, they were brought here to be the comprador bourgeoisie. They were compelled to live with each other because of segregation. They got to know each other, and it was one of the ways that they built their revolutionary consciousness, right? It's one of the ways they did it. So they lived around the corner, they had clandestine study groups, and when they were ready to continue with revolutionary organizing that they had already started on, they slipped out of Portugal and went on and eventually commenced the wars that led to liberation. In the context of what they did, it wasn't merely the fact that they managed to meet at a crossroads that mattered. It also was important that people spent a lot of time, not because they were academics, but because understanding how change happens matters, that they figured out, for example, an entire very elaborated education system for example, the peoples of Guinea-Bissau, 99% of whom were not literate at the time that that revolution started. And the education program that arose in the context of that revolution is best known to most listeners of our conversation today as Pedagogy of the Oppressed that Paulo Freire is most strongly associated with. Freire went to the revolution in Guinea-Bissau and learned a lot of what he then, you know, has helped to make a popular movement around Latin America and the world. So all of these are examples of what's possible if we take seriously the not only that universities are crossroads, but that we can bring together a lot of thinking and ideas and interactions that might not otherwise happen. That's all. It just might not otherwise happen. It's a modest thing, but it's also true. And I want to say one other thing about Cabral, not uniquely, but notably, Cabral was kind of in the margin of being a geographer. He was an agronomist. And agronomists, like geographers in general, are people who are compelled to understand the relationships of people and the places where they live in order to figure out how to reconfigure those places to make them flourish. And it's kind of well known that many, many, many agronomists in the decolonizing world became leaders in part because they understood a lot of things and could share that understanding with people, not because they were sort of naturally the bosses.
Right, which I suppose, optimistically, maybe we could say is as that's adjacent to geography. That could be, or perhaps is something we should aspire to as geographers, is to use that actual in-depth understanding we have or should have of what we study to convey the stakes and explain the dynamics to people. As well as, of course, supporting liberation movements or, you know, abolitionist-oriented movements as and when we encounter them, right? I know that you're continuing in this vein of educating other scholars and the public in your work. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you're working on now. What's next for you, or what can we expect to see from you?
Sure. I had a note to myself here. Yes. What's next? The book that I'm madly finishing up now, that will come out in October, is called Change Everything, which is another way of saying thorough reconfiguration. And it's a collection actually of lectures that I gave in a variety of contexts that kind of arose generally because of some kind of crisis, and then turned into a way of thinking about the world and the various strands that you and I have been discussing in our conversation today. And what I find the most exciting about thinking these things through is thinking about how many different currently active organizations of completely different types are doing work that, from my perspective, seems to be trending toward abolition in the radical sense, the thorough reconfiguration sense. So I'll give you some examples. One is the MST, the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, that's just celebrated, I think, its 38th year. And the MST has arose in the rural context of Brazil, mainly working with, as its name tells us, landless workers to figure out how to take control of, which is to say occupy, lands in order to create the conditions for stable and secure communities. So the MST in rural areas does a lot of agricultural work. There are schools, there are villages, there's everything. And currently, it is the biggest producer of organic rice in Latin America. And the rice is sold at differential prices to various communities, as well as given to people who, for example, people in Venezuela, because of the U.S. embargo, are having a hard time getting adequate nutrition. The MST's work has extended to working with people in urban areas, particularly São Paulo and beyond, who are vulnerable to the organized violence forces, not only of the notorious police and militias of Brazil, but also to those who've been delegated by the United States to interrupt long-distance migrants who might be headed to the U.S. or Canada. And so they've been doing work in creating systems of shelter and safety for long-distance migrants coming through, and working to combine the energies and capacities of people moving through with people who are living in precarious situations in urban Brazil. The MST famously, or should be famous, has done a lot of work, kind of outreach work, wherever they're called to go, places like South Africa, where self-organized communities who are part of the Abalali movement, for example, Kana in Durban, have worked with MST to figure out how to make the soils of the self-built community where they are flourish. MST sends people to Indonesia and to places that are trying to convert away from things like palm oil to sustainable and eatable kinds of agriculture locally. I also work with a completely different kind of organization, National Nurses United, many of whom are themselves long-distance migrants in the United States who, in the pandemic, could see very clearly so many of the contradictions of the current moment in their everyday lives. So one, long-distance migrants, or many of their colleagues are long-distance migrants. Two, they're struggling to have adequate staffing, equipment, personal protection equipment and support in the localities where they're working. And in those contexts, they have had to organize their local unions, but what are they fighting against? They're fighting against a global behemoth that owns so many of the hospitals. So the global local internationalism are all very apparent, you know, in the face of the pandemic and the sorts of devastation that the pandemic has moved through communities. So the nurses have put together really remarkable agreements in their annual conferences, resolutions that demand reductions in policing and prison expenditures and demand free healthcare for all. So that's another example. I could move on and at less length talk about, you know, the state of Kerala in Southwest India that because it's had for years a development plan that is not tied to the urgency for growth, which is what is wrong with capitalism, developed its own capacity to produce oxygen, which has been very important during the pandemic. And that oxygen has been available to people regardless if they're citizens of the state of Kerala. They can be anywhere nearby. There are many, many other examples that I could give you. So these are things that I've been thinking about a lot, people I've been talking with. I have learned over the years from the folks I've mentioned, but also people like Sonia Voss Borges, who wrote an amazing book about the PAIGC liberation education struggle that I talked about when I talked about Cabral, Maitri Prasad, who is an economist from Kerala, the Patniks, Stuart Hall, Walter Rodney looms large in my imagination at all times, as does Claudia Jones. I mean, there are just so many people whose work has mattered to how I go about thinking about things. And I suppose, you know, the last thing I want to say at this moment is that a lot of people who feel abashed about being scholars, or let me put this even more boldly, people who think that there should be shame in being professional intellectuals instead of people who understand the opportunity and responsibility of being professional intellectuals, seem to think that the only job we have is to kind of document, as in write down what communities say and then repeat that to somebody else. That doesn't make any kind of sense at all. Because we think about the variety of understandings that people have about why and how we struggle in the world, we see that any amount of struggle is only reinforcing and renewing the problem that others in the same community are struggling to undo. So our work, professional intellectuals, whether we're academics or writers or street corner preachers, our work is to make the contradictions apparent so people can start to see how the patterns that seem to completely cage us might, if we just turn our attention slightly differently, become patterns that we can use to undo the caging that we rail against and that many people think abolition at the end of the day is only about.
Right. Absolutely. And that's a great place for us to end. It's been wonderful talking with you today, Ruthie. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you, everyone else, for tuning in today. Once again, my name is Catriona Gold, and I've been speaking with Ruth Wilson Gilmore about her brand new book, Abolition Geography, Essays Toward Liberation, which was edited by Brenna Bandar and Alberto Toscano and published with Verso in May 2022. I highly recommend picking up a copy from your local bookstore, direct from the press, or from any other ethical retailer. For those of you looking for further listening, I know Ruthie has some excellent in-depth interviews with Navarra and The Dig, and probably more to come that I'm not aware of. But for now, thank you all for listening, and thanks again, Ruthie, for joining me today.
Thank you.